At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
SportsGrid.com. Betting insights and entertainment at your fingertips 24/7 as our team covers the most important topics in sports wagering. Real-time odds, predictive betting models, expert picks, and more. Want the edge? Then get on the grid. SportsGrid.com.
Live right here on the Early Line, we welcome you to hour number two of this Wednesday edition all across the Sports Grid Network. I am Ben Stevens. He is Donnie Wrightside. We are just a few days out from the start of the end. Week number 18, the regular season finale all around in the National Football League. Two games on Saturday that we will get you set for and an early look at the Sunday slate as well. All of that and more, Donnie, in this next hour. Two more hours to go up until 11 a.m. Eastern.
Yeah, a lot of good guests here are going to come on the show today, break down certain equations like college football, getting a little NFL taste, maybe a little bit of the hot stove action, but also, more importantly, some of these news and notes that we're going to get to in the NFL, because if you're not having that pen and pencil out, trying to keep track of who needs what, you're doing it wrong. It can cost you, Ben, money.
What week 18 has at stake for teams trying to clinch a playoff berth, win a divisional title, worry about their seed line once we get to the postseason, or individual metrics that we will look at in just a little bit. One individual that will not be with the New York Jets for their regular season finale is Dalvin Cook. What a disaster it was this year for gangrene in pretty much every single standard. Now 13 years without seeing the playoffs, the longest active drought from a postseason in North American major men's professional sports as it stands. In either the NFL, NBA, NHL, or MLB, 13 consecutive seasons for the Jets, now missing the playoffs. Let's welcome in that Sports Grid Radio audience here to our second hour live on the Early Line. He's Donnie Wright. Side. I am Ben Stevens. You're listening on Sirius XM, channel 159. All of our radio terrestrial affiliates now in the mix as well. Dalvin Cook not going to be with the New York Jets on Sunday. Not going to be with the New York Jets any longer. A mutual agreeing of parting of ways, whatever you want to call it. Dalvin's time in New York has come to a close.
Yeah, was he ever in New York would be the question right now with what he gave you. 214 rushing yards on the season, no touchdowns. One of the best pass-catching backs in the NFL with a chance to take any screen pass the distance. Finished the season with 15 catches for only 78 yards. And by the way, did we know Dalvin was cooked, Ben, from game number one? We're like, hey, we got this shiny new toy. We just lost our quarterback. Let's lean on Dalvin Cook. And he goes for 13 carries and 33 yards opening night against the Buffalo Bills. That was his season high in carries and the second highest total rushing on the season outside of his 35-yard outburst in the pouring rain in the Meadowlands against the Atlanta Falcons. This was one of those guys where teams were clamoring to get, and he commanded a high salary and did absolutely nothing. Yep. Now, hear me out on this. This isn't a case of misuse used by the New York Jets. Now, I truly believe that they got Dalvin Cook figuring that he was going to give them a lot more Dalvin Cook of what we saw from the Minnesota Vikings, and probably figured, Ben, you know what? He doesn't have to be the lead guy. We'll give him 10 to 12 touches a game. He'll be electric. I'll keep him fresh the entire way, and we'll make the playoffs. He was terrible every single game in every single scenario, which is something I didn't see. But when we talk about running backs hitting the wall, Dalvin Cook officially hit the wall.
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest with you. You talk about misuse. I don't think Nathaniel Hackett organized a good offensive game plan, maybe outside of the Chiefs game, one other time after his buddy Aaron Rodgers was out and injured. Maybe it wasn't an offense orchestrated for Zach Wilson or Tim Boyle or Trevor Siemian, but it was a disaster nonetheless in New York. Now, I don't believe Dalvin Cook was probably worth $10 million at this stage of his career, but the drop-off in production was so stark that I don't think you can blame just Dalvin. Because entering this season, the last four, he was a Pro Bowler in Minnesota. He had more than 1,100 rushing yards in each and every one of the last four NFL campaigns. Is he still going to be a 1,000-yard rusher each and every season at this stage of his career? Now, I believe 28 years old. No, but can he provide more production than what we saw this year for New York? Yes. How bad are things for the Jets, you might ask? Well, they're a 2.5-point underdog on the road in Foxborough against the New England Patriots on Sunday. The over-under for the regular season finale, 30.5. I guess the game has to be played.
Yeah, exactly. Some people are going to bet on it. Some people will enjoy it here. Some people will fade it. Some people won't even tune in. It's a great part about Week 18. There's so many other good spots to take a look at, but we still are going to have some clunkers, Ben, for sure.
And we look at Week 18, right? But we are still reminded of what happened on Saturday night in Week 17. The two-point conversion to Taylor Decker, that wasn't, because Brad Allen is a buffoon at being an NFL referee. And yet he's going to be in primetime once again on Saturday. We'll look at that in just a moment. The controversial call at the end of the game between the Lions and the Cowboys. As Detroit was about to tie it up, 20-19, they go for two. They throw a pass to their left tackle in Taylor Decker, who reported as eligible, according to everything that we saw based on video evidence and what the Lions were saying after the game, but yet a flag was ruled for an illegal formation and an ineligible receiver and an ineligible or illegal touch. This is what the NFL had to say in terms of what they sent in a memo to teams around the NFL with video explaining this entire situation. Quote, it is the responsibility of the player to be sure that change in status is clearly communicated to the referee by both a physical signal and to report to the referee his intention to report as an eligible receiver. Sounds like a bunch of mumbo jumbo for we screwed up.
Yeah, by the way, buffoonery all the way around, too, because I'm not going to let the ref off the hook here. But let's also be known about this. Dan Campbell knew he was doing something wrong before the game when he tried to say, I drew a picture for what was going to happen at the end of the game. Why? Because he was trying to dupe everybody here. Because everybody knows, if you've watched football at all, one guy goes up to the ref and goes, I'm eligible. And the ref goes, cool, and I'm going to announce it to the crowd. If you watched, three offensive linemen walked over to the referee to try to confuse the Dallas Cowboys, and all they did was confuse the referee. Now, the ref, that's your job to get it right, so he's not off the hook. But I'm not going to let that buffoon Dan Campbell off the hook for trying to sneak one over on the Dallas Cowboys. I actually love that it backfired, because if you just did it correctly here, Dallas probably isn't paying attention anyway to a tackle eligible, and you probably still score. But the fact that you were trying to camouflage that here to be smarter than everybody, love that it backfired all the way around.
It doesn't matter how many people walk up if one guy says, I am eligible.
But how do you know they're saying it? How do you know what anybody said? You have to go like Ben, literally, they run off the sideline, do this 15 times right up to the ref's face where you can't get it wrong. Nobody runs three offensive linemen where nobody moves any of their hand other than like maybe doing this. That's ridiculous. It's Detroit's fault and also buffoonery on the ref for not getting it right. I agree. But it's 50-50 here. It's 50% on Dan Campbell, 50% on that ref. And I'm glad he got tied up like that.
But if you report it, then it should be known, and it's the ref's job and responsibility then to report it to everybody else.
And why didn't Detroit call a timeout? Why didn't they call a timeout when they announced the wrong guy eligible? Why didn't they stop the play right there? Because they knew they were trying to get over on somebody.
Donnie Wrightside brings up some good points. Either way, Brad Allen working the Saturday game between Pittsburgh and Baltimore. More to come on the Early Line up next.
SportsGrid.com. Betting insights and entertainment at your fingertips 24/7 as our team covers the most important topics in sports wagering. Real-time odds, predictive betting models, expert picks, and more. Want the edge? Then get on the grid. SportsGrid.com.
I mean, just ridiculous behavior to start off this first segment of his first appearance on the early line of 2024. I was already worried about what was going to be said by our sports professor, Rick Horro. And then as we're coming back live, I'm sure you heard what was just a grueling sound from his mic. There he is, Rick Horro. Welcome to 2024. Glad to have you here on the early line on Sports Grid.
Playing through pain. Playing through a little bit of nasal congestion as the as your teeming millions who listen to you and watch you can hear. So happy New Year. Wrong side, happy New Year. Ben, how are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. The last day, by the way, on January 3rd, that you can say Happy New Year to an individual. Not a Happy New Year and not a Happy 2023 NFL season and maybe beyond for the Carolina Panthers, a two-win football team with the number one overall pick in Bryce Young, the worst record in all of the National Football League. They fired their head coach, Frank Reich, after only 11 games. And then on Sunday, in a loss to the Jacksonville Jaguars, David Tepper, the owner of Carolina, tossed a drink onto a fan. He was fined $300,000 yesterday by the NFL League office. His response, I am deeply passionate about this team and regret my behavior on Sunday. I should have let the NFL stadium security handle any issues that arose. I respect the NFL's code of conduct and accept the league's discipline for my behavior, end quote. Rick, what is the punishment? What is the reaction among the NFL league office and other owners of Tepper's behavior?
Well, first of all, there is now a mandate at Bank of America Stadium that there will be raincoats issued for the first row right below the suite, at least for the first six games until the team can actually be competitive again. Owners are incredibly intense and passionate. They all are. They choose to show it in different ways. One of the things that I do with the owners that I know is that I wish them a happy season. And I do it at the beginning of every season, game one, because I don't want to deal with the half of the owners that lost day one. And every week, half of them are really, really, really upset. And there's a cooling off period. If they weren't passionate, these guys are, you know, they'll do it for the money, obviously, but it's a significant investment. They want to hand it down to their kids and stop making excuses for a guy who, by the way, was more accurate with the glass than his quarterback was for the last 5 weeks of the NFL. But they've got to figure out how to control behavior and show it internally. So, you know, go into the bathroom and throw a glass of water on your face yourself or something. But these, you know, there's temper. You get carried away with it. If you and I were, or you or I were fined $300,000 for throwing something on somebody, you know, we'd never have any dollars to spend anywhere. So it's a fairly significant, here it is, and here's what we're doing. We'll just have to see how it plays out long term.
Yeah, it's the NFL does have, you know, a history of fining owners for that. I remember you don't have to throw things on people. Bud Adams, the owner of the Houston Oilers / Tennessee Titans, just flipped the bird to the fans and got a heavy fine for doing that. So the NFL certainly doesn't like top ownership level going after the fan base this year. But I tell you what ownership does love, parity in the NFL. We date back decades here, Rick, where you talk about Wellington Mara, owner of the New York Giants, say, you know what's good for the league? Let's keep the teams like Green Bay still involved. Let's revenue share. Parity, which everybody can profit off of. 20 teams still in contention for a trip to the Super Bowl heading into week 18. Talk about parity and why that's good for the NFL, Rick.
Well, let's go even further back that the Mara issue about sharing the television revenue and then spreading it out equally with the salary cap. Those things would never happen today. And also, look at Otani, just as contrast with Major League Baseball. You know, if the Dodgers spend the money right, parentheses, unlike the Mets do, they could be a champion for the next 9 million years. And other teams can't, not that they won't, but they don't have the means to do that. The Green Bay Packers do, and everybody else in the NFL does, and the parity is incredible. And look at some of the other parity, scheduling teams basically intra-division against each other the last couple of weeks. The draft picks, the supplemental draft, it's all based on Pete Rozelle and Paul Tagliabue's perfect comment, where I would like my league at the end of that 16-game schedule to have everybody go 8-8. And, you know, there are some people that say, I want a dynasty. I'd rather have parity where everybody has a chance than otherwise. You know, we were talking off the air about, would the Dolphins rather have a home game against Buffalo maybe the week after this for a second week in a row, or go to Kansas City as the number six seed? Well, those conversations I love happening because everybody's engaged. Whether I have an opinion and share with you or not, that's another story.
Yeah, that will be another story indeed. Miami, a three-point home underdog. The last time we saw the Fins at home in South Florida was on Christmas Eve Sunday, and it was a record-setting performance, not only for Miami in its victory, but based on the TV audience. 31.5 million viewers on Fox for the showdown between the Dolphins and the Cowboys on Christmas Eve. That game, Rick, was the most watched television program since 1995. Not most watched NFL game, not most watched sport event, just the most watched television program since 1995. What does that mean for the NFL as a business and as a product as a whole?
It means that the end of season scheduling and the dynamics of unveiling this Sunday and Saturday, they did it across all the networks. Everybody was talking about who gets the Sunday night game. NBC obviously had a chit that they needed to play. And probably the most important game of the weekend is the last game of the weekend, and the ratings are going to be astronomical again. Both teams will know whether one of them, the Bills, make the playoff or not before that game happens. And I don't like the idea of the three-point dog. I think the Dolphins will surprise some people. Now, whether they surprise people by losing by 30 or winning by 8, that's another story for you to decide. I think they'll surprise people, and I'm excited about the game, I will tell you that.
Big surprises, too. Miami wins, they're the number two seed. If Miami loses, they drop down to the 5 or 6. And also, if the Buffalo Bills lose this football game and the Pittsburgh Steelers win, Buffalo not even getting there into the playoffs. But if we take a look at ratings here, this is a reason why we flex games in the Sunday night. This is going to be a massive rating game for the NFL, but also college football, Rick, their massive ratings here from the Rose Bowl. 27.2 million people watch the Rose Bowl, 18.4 million people watch the Sugar Bowl here. A big win for college football. But why, Rick, do we have to start so late with the Sugar Bowl? Help the people out.
Well, it depends on where you live. You know, I mean, if you're in L.A. and you're watching the first one and then your night starts at 9 o'clock, it's the standard debate, East versus West. Remember, the Monday night football games would start closer to 9, and then they moved them back slowly. The East Coast decides what the ratings and schedule ultimately are. Perfect world timing, say TV executives, for any major event across the country is at about 6:30 Eastern. That's when kind of the combination of everybody will maximize. That's why Super Bowl kickoffs are about 6:20. So it's an ongoing dynamic. Just because you live on the East Coast, I know you're powerful. Yeah. I know you used to be a world-class golfer, but that doesn't mean you're going to sway the starting times for the NFL.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, Donnie Wrightside goes to sleep at 8 p.m., so it's not necessarily the strongest case if Donnie's asleep before the end of a game. Monday night's national championship in Houston between Michigan and Washington will kick at 7:30 p.m. Eastern time. They have moved up the start ever so slightly, still probably going to be about 4 hours and end around 11:30 midnight on the East Coast. Rick, normally I'd let you filibuster for the final 30 seconds and take us to break. But there is so much phlegm in your throat, brother. You got to go hit some Mucinex real quick. I hope you are sipping on whatever you need in that coffee mug. Best of luck to you. Rest up and feel better. Happy New Year, Rick Horro.
Dolphins by 4. Dolphins by 4.
Oh, my God. How's that? Oh, they're 1-4 against the spread as an underdog this year. The last 4 games as a dog have not been particularly good. We'll go back to college football up next, live right here on Sportsman.
SportsGrid.com. Betting insights and entertainment at your fingertips 24-7 as our team covers the most important topics in sports wagering. Real-time odds, predictive betting models, expert picks, and more. Want the edge? Then get on the grid. SportsGrid.com.
Live on the early line on Sports Grid on this Wednesday. It's Ben, it's Donnie, and now it's the mouth in the South, Mark Zeno, joining us for his college football playoff reaction and takeaways from what we saw on the first day of 2024 here on this third day of a new year. Mark Zeno, happy new year to you. How did it get started? Do you enjoy the CFP that we had on New Year's Day?
Well, gentlemen, happy new year to you both. I'm not sure how I can follow up our last guest to try and, you know, bring the entertainment value right where it needs to be. But I did have a great New Year's. I was very happy with the bowl games and the outcomes, and certainly the national semifinals went quite the way I thought they would, with the exception of the first half staying under between Texas and Washington. I tried to get a little contrarian there. And I believe if we don't get that stupid punt fumble that happens by Washington, we might actually keep that first half under. But different conversation for a different day, but great to be with you guys as always.
Bet Texas live plus 4.5 in the first half at the start of the second quarter. Love that bet there as well. Zeno, we start though with the granddaddy of them all, the Rose Bowl between two of the premier programs and brands in all of college football at the best setting in all of college football, maybe the best venue in all of sports. Number 4, Alabama, number 1, Michigan. Into overtime, the maize and blue prevail 27-20. Michigan covering as a slight 2.5-point favorite. Zeno, what was your main takeaway from the Rose Bowl between the Wolverines and the Crimson Tide?
That I think we all forgot, myself included, how good Michigan's pass rush was. Look, I know Alabama had problems on the offensive line all year long, but, you know, to get a mobile quarterback like Jalen Milroe on the ground repeatedly, the way they were able to kill drives, get him off the field on third down. And not only that, you know, when you talk about how good their pass rush is, you almost forget how good their secondary is at covering guys. Remember, you know, this is a secondary that decided to leave one guy alone on Marvin Harrison Jr. in the Michigan-Ohio State game and said, that's okay, we're going to run with what we got against them, and it worked out pretty well for them. So Michigan has proven that they are the best defense in the country by a wide margin. They've done it repeatedly, and I'm not sure, as we look forward here, that people should forget that about how good Michigan's defense is.
Yeah.
We take a look at that game too, Mark, and you're trying to line it up and say, you know, what could have Alabama done differently here? Had a touchdown lead late in the game, couldn't get off the field. Michigan scores that touchdown. But I ask you this question. In overtime, fourth down and goal, shotgun 5 wide, which obviously leaves Milroe in the backfield by himself. Didn't we all know that there was going to be a quarterback draw? And Michigan rightfully knew it as well and blew that play up right from the beginning. Did you feel that that should have happened? And you say, hey, look, he's been our playmaker all year. Or could you have been a little bit more creative with maybe a different formation on that final play for Alabama?
Well, Donnie, let me go backward here a little bit because, look, you know, it was pretty obvious to me that Michigan was beating themselves for a better part of that game, not Alabama beating Michigan. There was a litany of mistakes and errors that Michigan had made to allow Alabama to keep themselves in a game that probably should have been much, you know, wider than what it was. That said, in the second half, you saw Jalen Milroe was not throwing the ball more than 5 yards past the line of scrimmage. Everything was a wide receiver screen. Everything was a quick dump off. Everything was short. They were not going to chance him throwing the ball down the field because they realized that Michigan could cover and that he didn't have a wide of margin for mistakes as he did against Georgia or wherever else it was that they could chuck the ball down the field because it wasn't going to happen to them. So all that predicates what they did on fourth down, that if it wasn't going to be a Jalen Milroe designed quarterback sneak, all they were doing was throwing a quick 1 yard, 2 yard screen to the sideline and hoping they were going to get beat. Michigan proved at this point that guess what? You're not going to beat us one-on-one on the outside like that. Our guys can tackle. They don't miss many of them. So that was what the result was. And I think that they became very predictable, Alabama's offense in the fourth quarter.
So when I think of the game that Tommy Rees called, the offensive coordinator for Nick Saban and the Crimson Tide, I think he was pretty poor the entirety of it. I think Tommy Rees has outsmarted himself a few times this year, namely in the Texas game when he forgot what kind of athlete and the dynamic quarterback he had in Jalen Milroe, so much so that Milroe was not the starter for the following week against USF. But then they started to figure out their offensive scheme in the back half of SEC play. I thought they got away from that once again against the best defense in college football, in my estimation, this year in the Michigan Wolverines. And I thought that Jalen Milroe played with hesitation. I thought the offense was called scared against a maize and blue defense. Jalen Milroe is a great downfield thrower of the football with two great athletes on the outside with Jermaine Burton and Isaiah Bond. Maybe that separation wasn't there against one of the best passing defenses in all the country. That's where Michigan stacked up, only allowing 153 yards per game entering. But their final two in the regular season against Ohio State and Kyle McCord, they gave up 271 yards. And Talia Tungavailoa for Maryland threw for 247. Zeno, when you look at the quarterback comparison from the Rose Bowl, to me, that was the story of the game. Jalen Milroe looked like a shell of himself, only 116 yards through the air. J.J. McCarthy well over his passing yards prop of 187.5, finishing with 221 through the air and orchestrating only the second come-from-behind drive in a fourth quarter in his career in Ann Arbor. To me, Zeno, that was the story of the game. What say you?
Well, I tend to agree the quarterback play really is what separated it, and give some credit to J.J. McCarthy for the way he played. I mean, you know, some of those incompletions shouldn't even be incompletions. Guys, just he hit guys right in the hands, and the ball went right through it, and they missed him. So he played overall really well. But, you know, to your point about Jalen Milroe and the Alabama offense here, guys, I think familiarity in this case is really what made Alabama in the position that they were in. And what I mean by that is, yeah, Nick Saban knows how to beat Georgia because he's played them a dozen times and he knows exactly what they do, and so he can scheme against it. What was the last time Michigan and Alabama played? I mean, they, you know, this is just not a team that they see all that often, that they have a lot of reps against. And I think really that sort of scared Michigan in the second half when they realized that the adjustments that they wanted to make weren't going to be there. And Michigan's defense had everything shut down. And so they reacted accordingly. You could say it was conservative and everything else, but I think that they realized that, look, we're in a one-score game here. If we get down by two scores, we have no shot to get back in this thing. And so I think Alabama, to a certain extent, where you can call it conservative, played it wisely in a sense. Let's just keep it close, keep it close. Hope they make a mistake or we get a ball to bounce our way and all of a sudden we have a shot to go down the field and take a lead. That's exactly what they did. I don't think the coaching was poor. I think your argument is fair that maybe the play calling could have been a little bit, you know, more, you know, aggressive and tried to take some more shots down the field. But I think they played the game that was in front of them. Michigan, smartly having the ball last, so to speak, was taking advantage of it and finally put together a drive that looked like they wanted to go out and win the game.
Yeah, the adjustments were fantastic for Michigan late in that second half, moving the football down the field. But also, as Ben points out, it's a really good point. You saw multiple times in that game where you're dropping back at quarterback for Milroe, and he's firing passes right by the you know, wide receiver's head before he turns around. Not 20 yards down the field, 5 yards down the field, because his pocket wasn't nearly as clean as J.J. McCarthy's. Talking about some clean pockets, let's shift it over to the Sugar Bowl. We saw some very good quarterback play on both sides. 318 for Texas's Quinn Ewers, 430 for Michael Penix Jr. Watching this game and breaking it down, Mark, what did you find on these offenses? And it didn't surprise you that Washington was the winner, and what do you expect from Washington moving forward here?
Well, Michael Penix absolutely requited himself excellent on the biggest stage that he probably could, short of the national championship game. I mean, do you want to talk about dropping dimes 45, 50 yards down the field? It was impressive. Watch just a ball flick of the wrist, and all of a sudden it's right in the receiver's, you know, right in his hands in a bucket, you know, 45 yards down the field. That to me was what stood out the most. But, you know, once again, and this was part of my handicap going in, I feel like Steve Sarkisian and Texas were not prepared the way they should have been for this game. You know, and I don't know what it is about Sark, the way he can get a team ready throughout the regular season, but in these big moments, they seem to shrink. I don't want to put it all on him. Some of his players didn't exactly, you know, put together the best game in the best moments. But, you know, two things stood out to me. I think Texas's defense, I was surprised at how much they were caught off guard early. I thought they were coming in statistically, they were the better defense. I thought they were going to play like the better defense early, and they didn't. That was Washington. And really, you know, they could not really get the big stops when they needed them on third down. And that to me was a little bit surprising defensively. But, you know, Quinn Ewers looked like a shell of himself for a better part of this game. He just didn't look as effective as he did against Big 12 defenses. And maybe that's a referendum on the Big 12 and the defenses that they have going on in there, what's left of the Big 12, the new Big 12, that is, and the teams that they played against. But, you know, Washington certainly earned their spot in the national championship game. They were the better team on that field.
Yeah, Washington cannot be overlooked. As an underdog five times under Kalen DeBoer the past two college football seasons, they have won outright all five times. You know, am I crazy to say that despite Jaden Daniels winning the Heisman Trophy and despite the historical stats he put up this season, that Michael Penix Jr. is the best quarterback in college football?
I don't think you're crazy. I think the resume speaks to that. I think there's still some narratives out there about Michael Penix that he's injury prone and this, that, and the other. Look, what Michael Penix has learned to do more than anything is not put himself in positions to get hurt, which means he doesn't take off as much as he has to. And he certainly doesn't put himself in dangerous spots where he can get hit, because he gets himself out of the pocket fairly quickly when things get under duress. But to my money, you know, again, I told this to Falcons fans here in Atlanta who are clamoring for a quarterback. That's probably the guy that you want under center if you're a Falcons fan next year. And there's a variety of teams, I think, that will. Now, somebody's going to turn around and take Jaden Daniels and Drake May and Caleb Williams ahead of them to their own detriment. But much like the Carolina Panthers passed on C.J. Stroud in favor of Bryce Young, it looks like that was the wrong decision through one season of the NFL. Somebody may make that same mistake with Michael Penix.
I mean, Mark, when you look at what Texas did, I agree with the idea the offensive game plan was strange. I expected Quinn Ewers to attack downfield. Instead, they actually ran the football really well. C.J. Baxter, 9 carries, 64 yards. Jaden Blue, 9 carries, 59 yards. Dylan Johnson on the other side. We will look at his status. 21 carries, 49 yards in the Sugar Bowl for two scores as we get ready in just 5 days for a national championship in Houston between Washington and Michigan. A preview next.
SportsGrid.com. Betting insights and entertainment at your fingertips 24/7 as our team covers the most important topics in sports wagering. Real-time odds, predictive betting models, expert picks, and more. Want the edge? Then get on the grid. SportsGrid.com.
This show is known as the Early Line, live right here on a Wednesday on Sports Grid. In just 5 days, it will be a Monday in Houston, and that is a national championship in college football between Michigan and Washington. So on the Early Line, we find you the early edges for a national title game in H-Town in just 5 days. It's Ben, it's Donnie, it's Mark Zeno for a second consecutive segment. A 4.5-point number, Zeno, in favor of the number one team in the country, the Michigan Wolverines. The over-under stands at 55.5. Michigan has been booked as a favorite in every single game, all 14 so far this year. Washington has been an underdog now three times in 2023's college football season. They've won outright in all three of those games. So, Zeno, as you look at the number, 4.5 in favor of the Maize and Blue. The total stands at 55 in a hook. What is your first thought for the national championship game on Monday in Houston?
I didn't wait, Ben. I locked in Michigan -3.5 because I thought the number was short, and odds makers and the public or sharps have agreed with me as this line is now up to 4.5. You're not going to get me to ignore what Michigan's defense just did to Alabama. You're not going to get me to ignore what they were able to do to Ohio State. And you're certainly not going to get me to believe that Washington, and as much as I've lauded the Pac-12 this year in its final season and how good it was and how deep it was, you're not going to get me to believe that even as much as I had to applaud the Oregon Ducks for their season, that their defense was anywhere near as good as the one that Michigan is going to put on that field on Monday night in Houston. They're just not. My only concern, and this is really where the game will hinge for me, Michael Penix is one of the hardest quarterbacks in college football to bring down. If you look at his sack percentage rate, it's one of the lowest in America. If Michigan can't get him on the ground, if he can continue to run around and scramble and make plays happen when things break down with his legs, well, that may be the one thing that saves Washington and helps them move the chains and moves the ball down the field and keeps drives alive and gets them, you know, a first down on third down instead of getting them off the field. But that's the only way I think that they're going to present some problems for Michigan and this defense, is that they are going to have to extend drives, and Michael Penix is going to have to do it with his legs. But if you saw the way Alabama couldn't handle that pass rush and the way guys were covered downfield, I don't expect you'd see much different here against Washington. And Ben, you were talking about in the break on the flip side about how bad Washington's pass defense is. Look, Jim Harbaugh is still a really good coach, despite what you may think of him as a human or as a person or running an organization. That all that goes out the window when they snap a football between the white lines, because that guy could still coach and put together a game plan really well to go out there and beat any team in the country. He's not going to make the mistake. He's going to let J.J. McCarthy go ahead and do what he needs to do in the passing game. And then, oh, by the way, yeah, what? Up 6.5 yards a carry to Texas. What do you think you're going to do against Michigan, who's got a better offensive line and knows how to pound the rock for 60 minutes of a football game? I just think this is a complete mismatch on both sides. The line was short, jumped in early, taking Michigan here, laying it with the points, and I don't really have any reservations about it.
I agree with you on that. I think Michigan is the right side here because of what they can do in the passing game for themselves against Washington, which should open up the running game for themselves, which brings me into my next question. That total sitting for the national championship game, Mark, 55.5. We just saw a game in the Rose Bowl, which had Michigan in versus Alabama, right around 45.5. Washington and Texas into the 60s here. From a tempo pace here, is this game for you more of an over or an under play?
I think the natural reaction to say DRS would be that, hey, if it goes over, it's Washington, right? Because they have the better offense and they're going to score.
Yeah,
I would argue if this thing stays under, Michigan's in trouble. Because the last thing Michigan wants to do is be in a one-score game. It's an offense like this that really, you know, has the ability to make a play happen, right? Like, that's not what he wants. If Michigan is going to win this game, I think the script is get up by two scores and let your defense do most of the work here, and your offense can just kind of play field position game, almost like Alabama did against Michigan in the semifinal, where, hey, we'll punt three times in a row, put you in the shadow of your own goalpost, and you'll make a mistake or whatever, or you have to punt it away, and guess what? We get a short field to work with. Like, that's not the game script that Michigan wants. I think Michigan wants to be able to get an early lead here and dictate the pace and the tempo as much as they can. I just don't know that Washington's going to be able to stop this Michigan offense. Again, I know we continue to think of it as not all that prolific in the passing game. Remember, J.J. McCarthy was the most accurate passer in the country this year. So this is not exactly an offense that's going to make a ton of mistakes unless they beat themselves. I don't know that Washington has a chance to really come back against a defense like this if Michigan gets up two scores. So I say all this to say to DRS that this thing probably should get pretty close to over because Michigan is getting close to 30 here. Like, that's really the game script that they want.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Oftentimes, just in sports betting 101, if a team is favored by a score or up of that number, you often look at a favorite covering, and if they do that, there needs to be more points to cover that spread, win by a margin, and go over. If the underdog is going to win, you want to keep the point total as minimal as possible to stay within those margins and keep the number under. I think it's very different here. I think if Washington is going to win this game, that total of 24.5 for the Huskies needs to go over and probably needs to bring that full game over as well. Not to say that Michigan can't win a 31-27 football game, exposing some of that defensive deficiencies for the Huskies. I just don't think UW can win a game that stays under the number. So as we look at the two teams, you know, entering this football game, Washington is the best passing offense in all of college football. Michigan is the second best passing defense in all of college football. One thing I think we learned about the Wolverines, there was an idea that Michigan's defensive numbers this year were only because they played weak offenses in the Big Ten. Malarkey. That front seven, led by Mason Graham and Chris Jenkins in the middle, is as good as you will find in all of the sport. Michigan is the best scoring defense in college football. They ended the regular season only allowing 9.5 points per game. So, Zeno, when you look at these two teams, what they will both bring into this football game, Michigan booked as a favorite in all 14. They are now 8-5-1 against the number. Washington, an underdog, only 3 previous times. They have won outright in all 3. What is the key matchup that will define the national champion in the 2023 college football season?
I mean, I when I look at it here, I would probably look at somebody like Rome Odunze as a guy that Michigan is going to have to key on and not let him get his, right? Like, that's one of the guys where it's almost like when they played Ohio State, you just say, as long as Marvin Harrison Jr. doesn't beat us, we're going to be okay. And I think that's really the case here because, you know, Washington isn't really going to sit there and spend and invest a lot of time and energy into running the football. Remember, they had 100 rushing yards. 30 of those came from Michael Penix on the ground. And that's the other thing, again, as I said earlier, that they have to worry about. If they can't let Michael Penix run crazy and continue to move the sticks on his own. So there'll have to be some sort of shadow, some sort of guy who's just, you know, following him around the field. Because Michigan, as you said, Ben, with the front seven that they have, they only need to send five or six. They don't have to really send the house to go get Michael Penix. So they can afford to leave a guy back. Ooh. And really, when you look at Washington's offensive line, have they faced a pass rush like this all year long? Like, I don't know that the answer is yes. There are some good teams in the Pac-12 and some good players. Arizona probably would be the one that it would stick out to me as the defense that they played with a really good pass rush. But that was a lot earlier in the season, not compared to what Arizona was towards the end of the year. So I don't know that they've seen a pass rush like this, but I would, again, think that keeping Michael Penix from running and shutting down Adunze would be probably the two keys that I'd look at for the Michigan defense to keep Washington in check.
Taking a look here, Mark, tail the tape here from a quarterback perspective, J.J. McCarthy and Michael Penix Jr. If we take a look at FanDuel right now, the passing yards here, the total, 192.5 for J.J. McCarthy, Michael Penix Jr., 297.5. If we flip it over to touchdown passes, both of them are at 1.5, but really drastic prices. J.J. McCarthy plus 130 to throw two touchdown passes, and Michael Penix at a minus 158 price. If you're lining this game up, and I know you like Michigan here, shouldn't McCarthy have a pretty good chance here to throw two touchdown passes, even though we expect Blake Corum to get a few on the ground here?
Yeah, I mean, I would tell you yes, but also look at the Corum game last week. I would take over that 190.5. If McCarthy doesn't get to 200 passing yards against this pass defense, Michigan is upside down. Forget about it. It involves turnovers. It involves this whole thing going sideways for Michigan. To me, that feels like the way to go. Yeah, the passing touchdowns, maybe a little bit of a sort of coin flip here, DRS, where, you know, a pass gets him down inside the five, and then the smartest thing to do is just hand off to Corum for an easy touchdown. So I don't know that I would go there per se, but I definitely would look at that over 190.5. If he can't get to 200 against this pass defense, Michigan is in a very, very bad spot. Either that or Washington is being completely run over on every single play.
And I think Washington understands their deficiencies as well. I think the Huskies are still going to make the aerial attack of the Maize and Blue, coordinated by Sherrone Moore, beat them because they are going to have their work cut out for them trying to slow down Blake Corum. He went over 78.5 rushing yards with 83 in the Rose Bowl. A ton of those coming in overtime. And we said Texas did run the football really well against UW, nearly 7 yards per carry for most of the football game, but that wasn't necessarily the offensive game plan that needed to beat Washington. How difficult will it be, Mark Zitto, for the Huskies to try to stop that ground game led by Blake Corum on the other side for Michigan?
I mean, if they can't, Michigan is going to have a full complement of offense to toy with. I mean, really, there shouldn't be anything that they're not afraid to do. And look what the bag of tricks they pulled into. I know they tried that flea flicker that failed miserably and actually cost Michigan. I think thought they got too cute in that spot against Alabama. But, I mean, imagine a play like that when those guys see Blake Corum get the ball and everybody dives in, and then guess what happens? His wide receiver's running open down the field against two or three guys back there. I mean, it's just if they can't figure out a way to continually put Michigan in third and long situations by stopping them on first and second down, then guess what? I don't know that they're going to have much of a chance. Again, especially against a passer like McCarthy, who is very accurate, doesn't make a ton of bad decisions, albeit the first throw he threw against Alabama was an awful decision. But that said, all for the most part, we have a good track record here of McCarthy being really smart with the football. And Washington is going to need to play a near flawless game defensively in order to stay close in this one.
All right, let's have some fun hitting pay dirt here in the national championship game. Sides, totals, yes, they're all great. But the prop bet we want an answer to, Mark, is if we know Blake Corum is going to score a touchdown in the national championship game, but it's still priced at the FanDuel Sportsbook at minus 370, is there value there? And who else are you looking forward to scoring a touchdown in the championship game?
There's value there if you absolutely have, you know, money to burn. You're not going to get me to lay 370 on anything. I'm not doing not laying $3.70, not with Ben's money. And I know Ben is very generous.
Ben might lay that money.
You do it. I'm pulling for you, buddy. Absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, look, again, we've seen Corum do it through the air and on the ground, so I can't hate the bet, but it's priced that way for an obvious reason. And a guy who's got, 25 touchdowns this year probably isn't going to be shy of getting one more. But I think there's value in some other guys around here. And I would argue that, you know, I would look to something like maybe a longest touchdown pass that gives me plus money here, just because the openness that's going to be there in the pass game for J.J. McCarthy in Michigan to me is something that they may be able to take advantage of. There could be some wide receivers running free for a lot of yards after the catch.
Also, something to keep in mind, we saw Dylan Johnson, as Kalen DeBoer said it at the end of the Sugar Bowl, re-aggravate an earlier injury. Tybo Rogers, the backup running back, and Dylan Johnson for the Huskies have the same anytime touchdown number at minus 130. Mark Zeno, we appreciate the time as always. We end out this second hour up next on the Early Line.
SportsGrid.com. Betting insights and entertainment at your fingertips 24/7 as our team covers the most important topics in sports wagering. Real-time odds, predictive betting models, expert picks, and more. Want the edge? Then get on the grid. SportsGrid.com.
Ending out this second hour of a Wednesday Live right here on the Early Line on Sports Grid. I'm Ben Stevens. He is Donnie Wrightside, and this is the Sports Grid app, the ultimate sports betting companion app, available for download at both the Apple and the Play Store. Scan the QR code on your screen in a matter of moments. All of our information and insight available in the palm of your hand. So as we end out this second hour, we love hearing from you. Of course, Week 18 in the National Football League is on the horizon. Rise in the regular season finale all across the league. For some teams, it's about trying to earn a playoff berth, other divisional championships, maybe even just improve your seed line in the postseason picture. Other teams trying to win games, and then they're focused on the future and what is in store. As of last week, because Carolina is going to finish with the worst record in the NFL, and because they traded last year for the number one overall pick with Chicago, the Bears have the first overall pick for 2024. So what should the Bears do? That was the question. Fade the public. At Sports Grid TV on Twitter, who will be the Bears' starting quarterback next season? Justin Fields, Caleb Williams, or other? Right now, Johnny, in this Fade the Public poll, Donnie, Justin Fields is running away with it. Nearly 72% of the public vote at this moment. Is Donnie right side fading the public?
I am going to be fading the public in the spot here. Now, we're going to have another segment to break this down, but you see the voting. And quite frankly, I'm astonished that we're close to 72% here voting for Justin Fields, and only 24.9% here for Caleb Williams. It's going to come down to those two quarterbacks at this point here.
Correct.
But I have some differentiating circumstances that I'm not actually knocking Justin Fields, but the opportunity to take Caleb Williams might be too much for me to pass over, Ben, if I'm the Chicago Bears.
And that is all a part of this conversation. What is perspective value and what could be out there for Chicago? We'll continue the conversation when hour three starts in 55 seconds.
Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.